So we have Don online right now. We have Alana, Dave, Katya, and Laura in the room. A colleague of Alana's might be joining us in a bit. Otherwise, and Kevin Whitfield might be calling in. I gave him the conference call number. But otherwise, I think that's it for today, as far as I know. And yeah, so before we actually jump into the reports and some of the comments we got back and some questions we have, see if you all have additional kind of questions or things you want to discuss with the group. Some announcements that are going to be a little chunkier than usual, in the sense that I want to like say a bit about the next set of recommendations.
Just
a moment. Let me see if we have an additional person. So we're. What I wanted to talk about was kind of, you know, our next meeting is November 6th, and we may have some residual work from this meeting. I don't know. We'll see how things go today. But what we're going to put out next is some first penalty-related recommendations. And we've got it up on the screen. You'll see. Anyway, I think this will go out tomorrow, is the plan. And I just wanted to kind of preview it a bit, because it's also a different format and kind of presentation. It's, you know, styled as a report, has draft recommendations, but the recommendations really go to four things. And the chief one is, kind of as the title is, the ordinal ranking. So what we put together mainly is a spreadsheet let's zoom down. Right now it's in PDF version in here. Don't panic. Don't everybody get up in arms immediately.
I just can't see. So I'm getting not in arms.
So it's just kind of like, you know, it's devil's in the details. So you don't need to just let it blur. And but basically you're going to see the screen like this. And don't immediately leap to any conclusions, even from putting it on the screen now. You have plenty of time to leap to conclusions in writing and comments. Here's the thing. Number one, our goal and our ask on this is about the ordinal rankings, okay? So it's what, kind of relative to one another, what should be graded up or down. We have put in some possible absolute numbers. There are a couple models at the top. There was one already in the RCC below that's different, that at the top has, you know, life without parole. All of these are possible, and none of these are possible. It might be something different. If you have thoughts on that, great. But we're not making a recommendation as to the absolute numbers that go attached to the classes. Not at this point. What we're trying to focus on right now is the relative distribution and spread, okay? So, you know, first degree sex abuse, how does that compare to murder, right? Is it the same class, first degree murder, second degree murder, the enhanced form? That's the kind of like the distribution and array, whether something should be bumped up relative to others or bumped down. That's the kind of thing. I'm gonna be giving this to you in a spreadsheet form, as well as the PDF, you know, form. If you want, you could create your own spreadsheet, right? You know, just, you know, copy it, create a version of your own, and mark your own X's where you think things should be. You can, you know, selectively talk about a few things that you think are off. Again, the one thing I really want to emphasize, our main concern here is on the spread and the relative rankings. Like, for instance, and we have, for those who are not so Excel competent, not that any of you would be in this category. We in the PDF form, I sorted it two ways. one by the RCC citation, so you can kind of track it with our set of compiled statutes. And then the second way, which I now have on the screen, which just ranks it by ranking. So, you know, all the sevens are together, then the eights, and it lets you kind of look at, like, okay, what would be in the same box? It's a, think of it similar to kind of what the Sentencing Commission did, right, in terms of putting together its M1 through 9. This time, we also tried to go with 9 boxes for felonies, and maybe that allows some comparison there, maybe not. But again, our primary ask for this at this point is what needs to be shifted up or down.
Can I interrupt? Because I think I'm
sure.
Despite the fact that some of us had a number of years on the commission,
sure.
I think I was the only one who was on it at this time. This is exactly how we started with the guidelines, was
okay.
just to kind of put offenses in boxes, no numbers, no whatever. It was just to do exactly this exercise.
And did you start with a separate drug grid for drugs?
You know
or
the story. Are we on recording?
we are being but, you know, that shouldn't stop you. When does
it has never stopped me, it's true. We had 10 boxes, and we our homework between meetings was to sort of, we had the list of common offenses. What's in the boxes now, actually, is what we had to do. Not every offense, but just sort of the most commonly charged ones. And the commission at that time actually was mostly law enforcement. Even people on sort of other agencies were all former AUSAs. And the judges were actually former AUSAs, except, well. Anyway.
That's your memory.
Yeah, it felt like that. I'm making no comment. We're on the record. People were surprisingly close, and drugs were low. That's why they ended up on a grid of their own. We'll leave it at that. But it ended up sort of farther down, and people
Good.
Were like, this one's such a strange
sure.
outlier, particularly given the statutory max. We put it in its own. But otherwise, people were in pretty rough agreement about,
yeah.
you know, what should be...
Yeah.
I can't remember which way it went, which is one, which is 10.
Sure.
But, you know.
So I do hope that, like, look, we obviously there are going to be disagreements on this, and that is as it should be. But I'm hoping if we, again, look at kind of the ordinal rankings, the levels of seriousness, that we will be better positioned and kind of narrow the scope of disagreement, as it were, to then... the hard numbers as to statutory maxima or mandatory minima or lack thereof. This does not at all address those things. Again, I stuck, and maybe, you know, honestly, you could ignore them if you want, you know, some numbers at the top, right? If you want to comment on those numbers, great, and say, like, you know, whatever, the Model 1 layout of possible absolute numbers, or the Model 2 seems preferable, or the one we right now have in the RCC that we did an earlier draft of, with, you know, life without parole at the top. All those are viable, and none of them are recommendations. So we're what we want to focus on, again, is the relative ranking. What stays in the same box? What offenses stay in the same box? Now, again, and I'm saying things that will be in writing in the memo, but another thing I want to say is, like, look, we're doing this on based on the RCC offenses as they are now. I very much realize that you all have pending comments to us making changes, sometimes significant ones, on those. And I appreciate that, you know, we're asking you then to give comments or not on, you know, assuming right now the RCC, you know, statutes the way they are, even though they will change, right, in the next draft as we kind of address your various comments. Trick is, as some of you have already pointed out in your comments, you're reticent to make comments about the elements without knowing the penalties. And we have a chicken-egg problem here. And honestly, at some point, we just kind of need to dive in some of the penalties. So we're doing that. I appreciate that this might put you in an awkward situation because you feel strongly like, I don't know, you know, pick the offense. First degree forgery should be really different. And if it were different per your comments or your prior recommendation, well, then it would end up, we would think it should be whatever, in a class 4 instead of a class 6. That's all well and good. We'd welcome any comments on your kind of hypotheticals. if this, if you were to, you know, get our, you know, adopt our recommendation, then we would say this. But that's not what we're asking now. Our recommendation is assume the RCC as it is, assume these rankings, and evaluate the rankings are as they are here, the ordinal rankings. If in addition you want to comment about a kind of a hypothetical, or if you go this way and do the, great, you know, that's additional information, but that's not the, you know, recommendation that we're asking. There are a couple other things in here that are changes that we, it made sense to do at this time and to solicit your feedback on. One is jury demandability. We try to mark up at the bottom for, obviously, misdemeanors, what, as an initial pitch, we would recommend as being jury demandable. Take a look at that. Again, understandably, if you think something is misgraded, right, you know, it shouldn't be a misdemeanor at all, it should be a felony, right, then your comment may simply be, well, you know, I don't have any comment on whether it should be jury demandable or not, because I think it obviously should, has to be, because I suggest it be a felony, right, something like that. You could do that, but also for some of the lower ones, you know, something like trespass, right? Trespass of a government building. Okay. Is that jury demandable or not? You know, that's one current statute, you know, we're keeping in there. We know. So there are notes on that, because I know from past discussions and council legislation, obviously, that is another big factor in figuring out what people think should be ranked as a misdemeanor, felony, or even within misdemeanors, is it, you know, at the top end, you know, something around the year mark, or is it lower? Jury demandability, it may not strictly be about penalties, but it is a factor. Recognize that. So we've added that in, and there are specific recommendations on that, and that is something else that we would solicit any comments you have on this round. Last thing, well, sorry, two other things to highlight. The number of classes we have up there, like I say, right now, this is sketching it out with 9 felony classes and 5 misdemeanor classes. What we had before in the RCC is kind of like, again, just model numbers, was 8 felony classes and same kind of 5 misdemeanor. Any comments on that? Great. You may not use all the boxes. You may think that, you know what, and in fact, in none of our recommendations, we have an e-box at the very right for a fine only misdemeanors. We're not making any recommendations for fine only misdemeanors. It's kind of a null set. Maybe it should just be asked. Maybe you think differently, right? And if, or maybe you think differently about something else, you know, maybe it's the class 2 or class 3, because you would shift the few things, obviously, just serious human trafficking, sex abuse, you know, murder, you know, like those things should more run together and be bunched together in a couple of boxes instead of spread out. If you want to make a recommendation about that, that's great too. If we end up having a null, one less box, you think it can be done or should be done with felonies in 7 boxes, in 7 classes, great. Happy to hear that as well. Yeah.
Does the report give any information, or do you guys know, about how other jurisdictions that adopt the model penal codes did this aspect of it?
Did this aspect of it?
In other words, ranked it like this? Do we have information that,
no,
you know, 13 of the things have 7 felonies and 5 misdemeanors?
In terms of the number?
And then separately, the other question, which I think you already answered, is how they actually went about distributing it.
Right. We did have some information. It was in a prior, either the research memo or it might have been in a draft report, and I could report it, but you have what we have about like the number of kind of boxes, essentially, or classes that most jurisdictions have. That was kind of when we had first put together the 13 categories that was in the RCC before. Like I said, this slightly expands it to 14. I can tell you, you know, there are some jurisdictions that have more. There are many that have fewer. There are many that have much more, you know, sentencing guidelines that do not work the way ours do, that are, you know, have more teeth, and they are more detailed also. Obviously, the federal sentencing guidelines are, you know, detailed as well.
I'm talking about guidelines. Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, that makes sense. Right, and it is the relevant salient point, right, for determining penalties.
Yeah.
So, that's what I can tell you. Some are higher, some have more, some have less. Also, in what we put together before, we kind of noted how these categories, particularly what's kind of up there now, I guess right now is what was put up as Model 1, those penalties, that is fine only, 0 month imprisonment, one month, 3 months, 6 months, / 180 days, 1 year, 3 year, 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 45, well, not even 45, and then kind of a 60 or life without parole. The current DC code statutes, while we don't have a classification system, unlike most of the country, fall into this de facto, right? That, you know, pretty much all the current statutory penalties pick one of those in that Model 1. And, you know, there are unusual things. There's a 12-year penalty in bigamy or incest, something, there's unusual stuff, right, that comes up with different numbers. But by and large, these classes track where current statutes tend to fall in terms of what is the statutory maximum. Now, again, how you match up any particular offense to those statutory maxima, not aware of anybody who's kind of looked at how jurisdictions have gone about this. Again, most of the work in sentencing kind of changes of this. There's been a fair bit of work recently, but most of it's been on the sentencing guideline side and trying to, at that level, tackle changes. So.
A few questions.
Yeah.
Is this our chance to comment on felonies versus misdemeanors? What is a felony versus misdemeanor, or is that...
Sure. Yes. So if, for instance, first degree forgery, right? So sorry, it's, down here and, right now we have it down here for class 8. It's in felonies. Now, again, does class 8 mean 5 years? Does it mean 4 years? Does it mean 10
years? Can the person who's typing put us on mute?
Oh yeah, sorry, Don. I think we're hearing some background noise on your end.
That might have been me. I'm hitting mute now. Sorry, this is Kevin.
Oh hi, Kevin. Thanks for joining. Yeah, no, good to hear.
No problem. I didn't realize my speaker was that good.
All we heard was good the mic. Typing. We didn't hear anything else.
Wow.
Yeah. So if for first degree forgery right now, which is in the felony group, either you think it should be lower to the lowest felony or higher. Or should be a misdemeanor, now would be a time to do it, right? And it could be, you don't have to even say I think it should be a class A misdemeanor. You could more broadly just say it should be a misdemeanor. We're not going any further at this point until we see, hard numbers or something, but what I can say at this point is it should come down to misdemeanor, or again, vice versa, misdemeanor that should become a felony.
And in terms of the 9 classes of felonies, are you expecting this is something that can almost be like cut and paste into the guidelines or into the 9 categories of guidelines? I mean,
it's
not supposed to be a one-to-one track.
No. I expect that whatever we come up with, ultimately successful, or a version of it. Any changes along these lines will re-trigger a rethinking by the Sentencing Commission as to what it should be doing. as I'm sure some of you will still be doing as your hair gets grayer. And
you all will be consultants.
I have no vision of the future there.
It's audio, not video. That's
right. That's right. Right. The guidelines is its own system. We have a system that was set up in 2000, kind of in the very beginning of the wave of, guideline systems. Many state systems have changed significantly since then. You know, I don't know how they might change in light of these recommendations. One other thing, again, on the substantive recommendations, again, putting this in writing in the little kind of the beginning of the report, we have also brought in new dollar value thresholds for the property fences, right? So we have, like, as you may recall, or Alana, this may even be before you kind of we're joining the meetings, but you know, so for theft, forgery, like, they all have kind of uniform, right, you know, cutoffs for these different gradations. And we are recommending changes to those, bumping them up. And, you know, that should be part of this consideration because, you know, when you think about it, this is the same offense. All that matters is, you know, the grading choice is based kind of purely on what is the dollar value, right? It's the way it is right now in theft and fraud. But we're trying to, again, do that in a uniform, standardized way. And we have raised those thresholds. So please be attentive to that. And think
and
about
you'll see that in
and
like
you will
an
see it. Yep, it's like
or?
Here, you know, so second degree theft, sorry, or second degree fraud.
Oh, it has them out next to it.
It has
okay.
them in the chart even. So you can
okay.
just kind of look and see. And that should affect it, right? Like, whereas before, if second degree fraud was $200,000 or, you know, $20,000, you might have had a different view. Now, if it's $50,000 cutoff, well, you might think of a different grade, right? Maybe it goes higher, maybe it doesn't. But we wanted to put those in at this point for you to see.
And you're not looking for comments whether we agree with that, merely if it's like that.
You know, comments stating agreement are as welcome as comments stating disagreement. We don't get a whole lot of comments you know, on that, but certainly welcome.
Do you want us to comment, in other words, do you want us to comment on the proposed dollar changes, or simply should we assume the dollar changes and comment on the ranking?
We would love to also hear your any thoughts you have on the dollar comments as well, both. And so these are the things, again, I kind of lay them out in the report. A few more things. And again, apologize for taking time on this, but I think it's will hopefully alleviate some confusion when you get this material and start to look at it. We will also be sending out tomorrow a memo which provides some background information you may find useful. One piece of that is going to be a list of statutory penalties, just a spreadsheet we put together that has kind of statutory maxima. Okay, again, not focused right now on minima, but just on the maxima for how high it gets. And again, I think I did a PDF. You'll get both the Excel spreadsheet, so you can play and sort it as you will, but also like a PDF that's one is sorted by severity. So you can just kind of look and see, you know, for current DC statutes, what's getting life, how it goes down. As you know, the criminal code, the district's criminal statutes have never been reviewed in this way. Certainly, based on the sentencing guidelines, some of the statutory penalties on the books are not are out of whack with kind of where, for instance, the sentencing guidelines are. But it's a useful tool. That document will also have a bit of a side note: a list of the priority that our agency has been tackling and will be tackling in the coming year provision. So there will be a column there that you might find interesting, just doesn't need comment. None of this needs comment. This is all just background information for you to consider, but it kind of spells out the next offenses we're going to be working on, like in the coming quarters and for the rest of the year. So that'll be in that spreadsheet that you get. You might find that interesting too. A second spreadsheet that is going to come with the memo tomorrow is a more sortable form of the voluntary sentencing guideline chart. I don't know if you remember at the back of the manual, it has that detailed list of, like, you know, everything that they have done, they have issued guideline rankings for.
The one pager where it has everything by groups,
not
Appendix
the
C.
Like, the Appendix C, and actually what we took was the CI, or the C1, at the back, and we just cleaned it up a little bit to make it more sortable because to allow that. So again, something you can play with, but it'll list, all right, you know, M1 through M9. Here's the, you know, when you're looking again at the ordinal rankings, that we thought that would be a useful thing to be able to visualize and see. So that will come out also and be attached. Just again, background information. A third thing that I will send out by a separate email tomorrow. So, and this will be some court data, right? As those of you know, you know, we've had a long to-do kind of getting and cleaning court data, find out what's going on. We have now, we have a data use agreement with the court that's allowed us to get some data to do some analysis. That data use agreement with the court limits what we can distribute, how we can distribute it, how it can be used. We right now have kind of a permission to distribute to you some information. So that's what we will give you tomorrow via email. It is not, without more from the court, not something that I'm going to put on the agenda for discussion yet. I'm hoping that I can secure some additional clearance from the court to follow up with and make that data more a something that we post on our website and can kind of, you know, fully discuss, etc. I think that will work out. We're not there quite yet, so I will follow up. But for now, I do have permission to kind of send directly to you some of the statistics that go cover a 10-year span. And again, is sortable by maximum, you know, imposed sentences. There are many ways you can cut the data. We're continuing to do work on it, but I think it'll be also very informative, again, of like, look, what's the relative ordering? And it's a data set that, or analysis that will also be useful when you start to think about what are the absolute numbers. Again, we're not there, we're not making recommendations on that right now, but I think just seeing kind of what's come out will be informative. Okay. The other thing that'll come out tomorrow is just an updated compilation of all the statutes, right? Since we've added in drugs and guns, we haven't gone back to kind of redo the whole thing. So we will be, you know, just the straight up compilation of here's all the statutory language you've received. We'll be updating that to include, last time we did this was in April. So we're going to update that April version to add what you've already received for guns and drugs.
So it'll be the revised, it'll be what, whatever those, that report was, that was the huge one. It'll be those changes you made.
Mm-hmm.
Adding this, and will the new property things be in it?
The numbers will be changed for, right, these property value thresholds.
Okay.
A smattering of other formatting problems and, you know, super technical stuff, but like nothing else substantive.
Okay.
So it's really just, again, an updated compilation. The idea is just as you begin to look at this, right, you're going to be like, oh, right, second degree theft. That happened, you know, 2 years ago. What were the, you know, and you might want to review. Anyway, so we want to put that back together, put it all in one place. So you have that. You have the spreadsheet, like you're seeing on the screen. You're having background information on statutory maxima. You're having background information on voluntary sentencing guidelines. You're having background information on court statistics. You may find those relevant. You may not. Right, in kind of a, you know, commenting on the recommendations. Our focus is on the recommendations, though, not on those other things. Right, I want to really emphasize that. One last thing that you'll be receiving, it'll be the next week, probably towards the end of next week. We're still finalizing some things. Is some public opinion data that we've been able to gather about. Kind of putting for district voters, getting their opinion on certain, again, the relative severity of certain kind of hypothetical criminal conduct. it'll be much more self-explanatory when you see it, but basically it's asking in a web format, we use a vendor, to describe again the relative severity of things like possessing a syringe with intent to use it for heroin, robbing $50 from a store cashier. Different short hypotheticals. Now, much could be said about like survey methodology, et cetera, et cetera. Happy to address that down the road. I think once you kind of see what we've got, and surveys happened, yes, and we will give some of the background information on how this works. And here's what I would say too: it is not at all a kind of a one-to-one. Oh, you got this response on this question, therefore, the people think X. Obviously, it's much more complicated than that, right? And we take that with many grains of salt. But why we did this is that we think that public opinion as to, again, the relative severity of offense. We didn't ask about hard numbers. We didn't ask about, should there be, life in prison for X or for this, or, what we think is that those public judgments about what is more serious than other offenses is certainly relevant to this work. Looking at the law in the books, looking at what's in practice coming out of the courts, looking at the voluntary sentencing guidelines as they've emerged and been used and some, generally agreed upon, as such as they are, and looking at kind of public opinion. Those are some, again, different types of background information that we're all putting out there for your background consideration, okay? We don't think any one is dispositive. I doubt you all will either, right, as to what your recommendations will be, because there are problems aplenty in, the laws as they're written. That's why we are here. We're trying to find a better way forward. So, we're putting all that out there. We're giving you kind of everything we've got, like on the survey data, where you'll get the questions, you'll get, you'll get everything. You can scrutinize the methodology if you want. For better or for worse, you may like it, you may not. But we're just giving you what we got.
Is the survey part of the report or by email?
No. The survey will be separate, again, next week. And it'll be probably in the form of an advisor group memo, and go up also then on the website, because it's, we just want to make that available. All right. Kind of final thought on all this sentencing work, and I kind of preface it by saying, I got an email earlier in September, but since our last meeting, from a mother whose son was the victim of a pretty, brutal attack, and she, stated her concern and confusion about, right, the criminal law, and particularly its penalties, and even just kind of struggling to understand what was there. And, we can't offer specific legal guidance, and, it sounded like she had a critical experience with the criminal justice system at multiple levels. And I guess I raise that both because, obviously, as we begin to talk about penalties, I want to just kind of appreciate the fact that this has a lot of consequences, and that reasonable people can and do disagree on this very sharply. And I'm hopeful that, as we go about this, we can appreciate that, again, people can reasonably take very different positions on this. So I'm hoping, yes, to keep everything at a civil, level as we kind of have these conversations. I'm hoping we can start, and by looking at the ordinal rankings versus going straight to absolute numbers, that we can begin to find more points of agreement at the beginning, and then focus more on the disagreement as well, as to like, what needs to shift. There will be disagreement, and one thing that definitely came out of our survey findings is while by and large there's the majority of folks have a lot of agreement on a lot of core issues, there are some issues where public opinion is much more you look at the plot of where survey results come out and it changes for some topics, right? Because people are much more scattered in their views. So, look, this is what we have. We're going to try our best to do this in a civil way. Appreciate your help with this. And also, again, appreciate that this is a stepwise thing. This is our first draft we're getting out. There are going to be problems in it. We're going to look at it ourselves and realize there are problems. But this, I think, will get the ball rolling on penalties. And your feedback will be helpful to the extent you can give it. So, there's a lot of discussion to lay this out, but again, I don't want you all to feel confused. Obviously, we're here. If you have questions, you get this new set of materials, and look, again, in the end, you can give whatever comments you'd like. It will be preserved as part of the record. Again, there's specific things that we're asking about. We're not specifically not making any recommendations, to say it again, on like the maximum, what is the absolute number, but there's still plenty here. Dare I ask if there are questions at this point?
I've got two.
Yes.
When do they do?
Going to be about 6 weeks in the mid-November.
And the other one, well, I'm not sure you might have addressed. We're only talking about the maximus. We're not talking about things like no less than blank.
That's right.
Or.
And there will have to be a separate conversation down the road about should there be minima? Are they statutory minima? Are they mandatory minima? Are they by class? Are they kind of more exceptions and that we don't have any generalizable thing? We, at this point, just the maximus setting. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't want to cut this short.
No.
I know that Steve has to leave at 11, so I'm happy to keep talking about this.
Good. Nope. Great. No other questions. Like I said, feel free to give us a call. You'll get the information. You'll chew on it. And like I say, most of it will all come to you tomorrow, or we plan to issue it tomorrow, with a follow-up on the kind of some of the public opinion stuff next week as it gets finalized. Great. Okay.
And sorry, when will it be due?
6 weeks from Friday, I think, is what I had.
So November 14th?
That sounds right. Ish.
Ish.
Yeah. I don't have the date right in front of me, but yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Good. If no questions, I'm going to turn things over to Janu to talk some about the comments on controlled substances.
Should we start with OAG's comments? Should we start with USAO's?
Okay.
I'm happy to answer questions about stuff, but I know he has more expertise in the field, so.
Sure. Not too much. One of the comments we got from the attorney's office is that they want to just insert the language, a compound or mixture containing the particular controlled substance for all grades of the offense. And I just want to talk about, is that because your understanding is that if we don't include that, then for those lower tiers, it would have to be a pure substance, so that if we said just distribute, distribute cocaine, that would require pure cocaine, and that's a mixture.
Right. The current schedule has a quantity or mixture containing in the amount of cocaine, but then it just says heroin. And so our court of appeals has interpreted that as requiring a quantifiable amount of actual heroin, whereas it's only a detectable amount of a substance. It has to be a measurable amount of a substance containing cocaine, but just a detectable amount of cocaine. So in practice, that means the lab has to quantitate and do purity testing for heroin, but not for other drugs. And so if we don't include, and that matters the most for the lower quantity offenses,
right,
because there are quantities below which it's more difficult to assess purity. So I do think that that is, so for example, a one zip of heroin case, we may not, absent extraordinary circumstances, we may not charge that case right now because we know the lab's not going to be able to quantify purity. And so I do think it has very substantive effects if we change it for other drugs, as well as for heroin, if we change it the other way for heroin. I think that controlling heroin versus a substance containing heroin is a pretty meaningful substantive distinction.
Okay. There was another comment about, so we, you know, we had this for a penalty enhancement to commit trafficking offense while armed. We had this requirement that the weapon then be used.
I'm sorry, I just want to understand what does this suggest? I see compound or mixture. Where are you talking about that it needs
tiers
to be added?
It's only in some of the gradations, and it's not in all of them. We can set up.
Right, but it's in the gradations where it's weight. What difference does it make? You have to have. That's what I've just.
Right.
Gradation.
For
I'm looking at trafficking. Should I be looking at something else?
We don't look at third degree trafficking. We didn't include a sort of compound or mixture.
Right.
Because our thing was that quantity doesn't matter for that tier. So
right. So I don't understand. That's why I don't
mixture,
understand.
It would still matter, even if there's not an enhancement for quantity, because we have to still prove some. We have to prove a measurable amount in order to get a conviction for even the simplest possession. And so there's a difference, regardless of whether you're talking about a kilogram or 100 kilograms or anything else, if you're talking about a measurable amount, there's a difference between a measurable amount of heroin and a measurable amount of a substance contained in heroin. And right now the law is split, and it actually matters more in terms of provability at the lower quantities than at the higher quantities. So right now, this law says a substance containing cocaine, and it just says heroin. And our Court of Appeals has not a substance contained heroin. So our Court of Appeals has said that means it's you have to do a purity testing for heroin, whereas you don't for cocaine. And so it matters right now in terms of what we can charge for heroin and cocaine. I don't, I understand there's distinction. We could argue about the where that line should be drawn, but I do think it's a line that matters a lot for us in terms of what we charge.
Wait, so this may just be a science question. There's some measurable distance between detectable and measurable quantity. Is that what you're saying?
So we oftentimes will get reports back that will say it's 0.7 grams in the sample. Exhibit 1 contains 0.7 grams. Controlled substance detected, heroin. Purity, *, and then note down at the bottom, quantity not sufficient for quantitative analysis. And so they've done a qualitative, they've done whatever they need to do to measure the substance, and they've detected heroin, and they return a result saying so that would be a measurable amount of a substance containing heroin.
Right.
It would be a detectable amount of actual heroin, but it's not a measurable amount of actual heroin. And so
I
we would, absent some other evidence of intent or attempt or something like that, we may not proceed to trial on that lab report. Whereas if the result was instead of heroin, it was cocaine, under the current law, we would be able to proceed to trial because we have a measurable amount of a substance containing cocaine. So it does matter for the smaller quantities, and it does create a difference in the different drug types.
That's the Scotty Vail case, the MOJ, right?
There's previous, I think Price is a published decision from the Court of Appeals about it. I think Price and Ott's.
And heroin is the only, that's the one that right now
some
has
of the
been recognized.
In the SAFE Act, some of the synthetics have the language and some don't, heroin's the main one that we end up dismissing cases on.
So with respect to heroin, adding that language would then change current district law?
Yes.
Okay.
But for cocaine, not adding that language would change current law.
I see. Okay.
And I think for all of the other drugs, it's the same.
Yeah, right.
Cocaine, meconine,
all the ones that, right, they're currently defined to include compounds or mixtures.
Right.
I see.
It's helpful.
Yeah. So we had recommended having a while-armed enhancement for the drug offenses. And again, we require the sort of in furtherance element of it, so it's not mere that you just happen to have it. And I sort of there's any circumstances in which a person has is possessing or has readily available firearms. Maybe someone's packaging some drugs, they happen to have a recreational target shooting gun in the closet next to them. It's readily available, has no relationship to the offense, but the police find it. I mean, do you so still think that there should be any limitations on that, or even on those facts, the enhancement or separate offense should apply?
So yes, feel free to add on. But I think the kind of main thing that we, a gun, obviously, introducing a gun to an offense and having possessing it while you're committing this crime raises the odds of both intentional and unintentional discharge of a gun, right? And it increases just the potential danger inherent in a situation. And somebody who's trafficking a controlled substance with a gun and trafficking a controlled substance without a gun bring different levels of danger to it. And even if that gun is not used in further, even if we cannot prove that it is used in furtherance of the crime, there is still an enhanced level of danger that you bring to trafficking, because this is just trafficking that we're talking about, when you introduce the gun. I think also practically, proving that it's being used in furtherance of might be difficult to prove. Mm-hmm. You know, if somebody just kind of has that gun and, you know, other people in the area know that that person is known to carry a gun. I think probably realistically it is being used in furtherance of it because it kind of helps you with your drug territory or whatever it might be. But I think for us to be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the gun was being used in furtherance of the crime might be a very difficult burden for us to meet, even if the dangerous factors are present.
So what are you proposing?
Eliminating the words in furtherance of and just saying possessing a firearm while committing the offense.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So
I think I've got it on the screen. I just have like the...
And yeah, that
so is not necessarily having any connection to the offense whatsoever.
But that's consistent with current law.
Right.
But isn't in furtherance of consistent with what you have to do in federal court, in every federal court?
I don't think it is. My understanding and my reading of the statute, and I put this in the comments, and I know that the commentary cited to 924C1A, that actually says that there's an increased punishment if the person uses or carries a firearm or who in furtherance of any such crime possesses a firearm. So I think it does have the possibility of the using or carrying a firearm, and the in furtherance of is another possibility and another method of liability. So by allowing, the federal law said that if you carry the firearm, you are also liable. So you're
suggesting carries more than possesses? I mean, is there some connection to the crime, or you aren't in favor of any connection to the crime?
I mean, I think...
Under the current statute, we've, I think, litigated against you all in one case that there doesn't have to, you don't have to prove...
Right, so this is reform, so I get it. So I'm wondering if you all are moving. You just think that's it. Okay.
We think that's inappropriate.
Okay, we object. We like this in furtherance. I was thinking we could maybe like have a conversation about it, but no, we like this.
All right.
Use and carry, you would be okay with use and carry?
Sounds like not.
It's better than in furtherance of. I don't think that it's what we, I don't think it's our preferred position.
In the alternative.
Better, but I think uses and carries is
better
than furtherance of.
Okay. So next, we've included defense, the person distributes or possesses with intent to distribute drugs, not for financial gains. It's like if you're sharing it with some friends, you know, that would not count as trafficking. And the OCO in their comments point out, like, well, in the case of quid, it can be really difficult to prove the person was either going to sell it or gift it, which is fair enough. But would the USA be okay, at least in the case of when there's an actual distribution, so when the person actually hands over the drugs to his friend at a party, just sharing it, there was no money exchange, that the defense should at least apply in those kinds of cases where there's a real distribution? Or?
I mean...
Can I just say, and maybe you guys can comment, because we may not agree on this, but we had a similar comment in ours, and what we said in OAGs was, it's one thing if you're giving something that's a personal use amount, so I'm giving you a joint, I'm giving you a line of cocaine, whatever it is, versus a situation, because the way it's drafted, no amount is in there. And so if there's no discussion of a trade or anything, it could still be a trade because you know I'm going to get paid later on. So we made the distinction at the single use amount.
That would be the re-up scenario, right, where the observation post sees someone bringing a large quantity to the scene to give to the street dealer, that we might not see a return exchange for money, But if there's a distribution of a large quantity from a car to a street dealer, that would be something that we think should be criminalized.
That's exactly right. So I drew the line, or we drew the line, at the single use amount with no remuneration.
We continued talking and consulting after the comments were due, and I don't know the extent to which you are taking comments after the deadline. But to the extent you do consider comments after the deadline, and only a week after, we'd actually be in favor of moving it out of defenses into an element that distribution has to be for in exchange for something of value. Or an expectation an expectation of a future financial gain, and that has to be proved in every case as opposed to a defense.
Right, which satisfies your concern about the not money immediately exchanged, but it's clearly a commercial transaction.
It doesn't satisfy my issue though about, you know, I give the guy a quarter of a bag of cocaine. So it's not like in a classic street setup. It's evidence of multiple uses,
right,
more
so
than anyone would.
So there are cases where it probably is part of a commercial stream.
But there's going to be no evidence of that.
Right.
When you flip a guy 20 grams of cocaine.
Sure. But from the user's position, you know, even if it is just like a line of cocaine in a party, you know, where there actually is a distribution, what's here, have some of my cocaine, the person, you know, takes it, not for money, if you say would at least be okay with the defense applying when there's an actual distribution.
So
clearly there's some uncertainty of what's going to happen in the future.
I think the main objection was kind of the broader implications of what this is actually going to do for prosecutions and not necessarily to the theoretical underpinnings of it. And I think the theoretical underpinnings are, you know, we're just concerned that it's going to have a broader applicability and that everyone is going to kind of try to invoke this defense, which is why I respectfully disagree and think it should remain a defense. But I think that is kind of our main concern is, you know, if someone just says, oh, of course, I'm just giving this to my friend, how could you possibly think that I was distributing this for anything else, that scenario is going to frequently be a difficult one to overcome, even when, in fact, it is not true.
Right. Though this does arise in... It's a very similar issue just arises in a typical Puig case where someone can always claim, like, no, but this was really just mine. I was not going to give this or sell this at all. And we don't know. But experts come in and say, well, given the quantity, given the way it was packaged, et cetera, and then fact finders have to decide, yeah, we don't really believe this person saying it's just for their own personal
Sure,
reasons.
But I think
so
if
similar,
you have this defense, they're going to say, oh, I know it wasn't for not for personal quantity, but I was only going to give it to my friends. And I think that's kind of something that how could a drug expert, it would be difficult for a drug expert to rebut that conclusion, you know, just saying, oh, I was going to go to a party and I was just going to
give out
all these amounts of quantities to my friends. And I think,
I don't know
how a drug expert's testimony could go to that person's plans at a party, you know. And so we're just kind of concerned about the broader implications when it is not in fact true. I think the situations where it's in fact true are not at the heart of our concerns.
Okay.
So I think it is important for us to think about how the cases will be proved, how what evidence might be needed, and particularly in thinking about elements versus defenses, who's going to be able to prove something. I don't think, however, it's the first line for thinking about what the offense should be. I don't think the first line for determining whether we're criminalizing conduct should be what can the prosecution actually prove, but what we think should be a crime, or a gradation of a crime, if that's a possibility of thinking how to split this baby. So I do think I'm not sure what the comment was about theoretical underpinnings, but I think that's where I am, is the theoretical underpinnings is the first place to start, is to understand, I actually think it is the conversation between U.S. Attorney's Office and OAG, I'm just sharing it with my friends, is criminal conduct or not criminal conduct, leaving aside whether a drug expert can comment on it or not. can opine on it.
Criminal as trafficking, yes. Too, right? Like, we've always got possession is out there separately, but, like, you know, no, not necessarily consciousness. Right. That's another recommendation from PDS on decriminalization of person. That's a separate issue, but
yes.
The short answer is yes.
But I do think that what we're trying to bring to the table is kind of the practical implications. Because I think that you're all very aware of all of the kind of more theoretical underpinnings, and I think that where we can provide more value is kind of the impact it's going to have on our prosecutions more globally when, and the unintended effects of such a provision.
So short answer, yes. I mean, what about Dave's comment? I mean, is it any amount? Is it here, hold this joint for me, and you're like, that looks like a change of transfer of possession. So distribution, you're gone. Okay, marijuana is complicated, but like, here, hold this zip for me. I'm running over to, you know, I don't know, get a coffee.
I think giving a line of coke to someone else at a party is substantively more serious offense than possessing it for your own use. I don't think that is it. At least I won't speak for everyone else, but I think there is a substantive difference there.
Great. I think we can move forward unless there's anything more on this.
Sure.
Is there anything else?
Just one last quick thing. So for possession of paraphernalia offense, we'd recommended limiting it to possessing paraphernalia for purposes of manufacturing a controlled substance. And in USAO's comments, they noted, you know, but this would decriminalize even possessing things for distribution of controlled substance, so baggies and, you know, whatnot. Didn't say anything, though, about possessing paraphernalia for just ingesting, you know, pipes. Would USAO be okay with even just decriminalizing items for just ingesting personally controlled substances, or just want to retain the current possession of paraphernalia offense?
I think we probably have to, before we say we're in favor of decriminalizing crack pipes, I think we would need to check back and before taking that position, but I do think that there is a substantive difference there as well between the syringe and the crack pipe and the empty zips and the scale, which are not for manufacturing, but, you know, we do have cases where you'll get, you know, 200 empty zips and a scale in a car, which can be pretty powerful evidence that of a distribution operation, which would not be affected here. So I think that we would certainly take a stronger position in defense of the distribution paraphernalia than of the using paraphernalia.
I think also in terms of the hierarchy of our objections, there are other ones that we feel far stronger
sure.
about.
Sure. That was all right for the great. So.
Thank you for coming. Appreciate your time. And yeah, we'll move forward to some of the. If you have extra time, I think there were some other questions for OAG and maybe for PDS on drug.
But no more
for USAO on those offenses.
It's a CJCC conference call about a different project, but I emailed them and I'll step out when I'm needed for that.
Great. Thank you. Sure. Yes, we'll be back to some of OAG's comments. So for our possession of controlled substance offense, we recommended splitting into two grades. The first degree version would be the drugs that are currently categorized as these abusive or narcotic drugs, and then just any other controlled substance would then fall into the second degree version. And USAO recommended instead using...
USAO or OAG?
OAG recommended using just the schedules. I believe it was schedule 1 and 2.
The question that we really wanted to pose is the ones that have the enhancements, and granted they are the enhancements on current law, are mostly Schedule II drugs. And it seemed odd that drugs are scheduled by severity, harm, and usefulness, and that we have enhancements for what are mostly Schedule II drugs without having any enhancements for what are Schedule I drugs. In D.C.,
sure.
I don't want to talk about federal
sure.
Schedule I drugs, but for D.C. drugs, and that just seems odd to us, that if you're going to make a distinction for Schedule IIs, some Schedule IIs, that behooves you to also make the same kind of enhancements for Schedule I.
Right, and yeah, again, so we were mostly just drafting on the current law, the current definitions.
Yeah, no, I understand. But, I mean, to me it's baffling why you would have enhancements for some Schedule IIs when you don't for
sure.
Schedule I mean, ones, which are more harmful.
And obviously schedules are long and they're complicated.
Yeah.
Were there any specific things you think like these should not be, because they're Schedule 2, they really shouldn't be bumped up?
No, no, I was, the Schedule 2s, I agree, are pretty much a reflection of current law. It's the ones that you identified, right? So we're not commenting on that.
Okay, so nothing about specific offenses, specific substances. Just when we look through, again, so a lot of complicated decisions going to scheduling, and if we just went with Schedule 1 and 2 as sort of the top grade, all of the schedules lower, there'd be some somewhat bizarre results where, you know, methamphetamine is currently an abusive drug against labels that would go into our higher tier, whereas psilocybin, so hallucinogenic mushrooms, is a Schedule 1 drug. And those things would then get penalized the same, which, you know, seems a little bit odd, I think, given the sort of, notwithstanding the scheduling decisions, sort of the actual harmfulness of these drugs. And there may be like any number of other sort of bizarre outcomes if we just went with scheduling. So we're just sort of curious if you had like sort of specific.
No, we didn't go through all the Schedule 1s to identify.
Yeah.
Really, because to us, that was the criteria for being in Schedule 1.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there. Go ahead.
No, I understand what you're saying about psilocybin.
Yeah.
Well, right. And I mean, just so we're kind of clear, your recommendation would raise some Schedule 2 drugs, the penalty for it, to be equivalent now with Schedule 1 drugs, right? That's your recommendation for...
No, I would word it differently. You have the enhancements for some Schedule 2 drugs, and we're saying that we think the enhancement should apply to Schedule 1 drugs.
So all Schedule 1 and 2 drugs would be treated the way that we've recommended these abusive narcotic drugs.
Or in the alternative, Schedule 1 and the identified Schedule 2s that you have. I'm not necessarily...
Dave, what are you calling enhancements?
Okay. I'm sorry, I'm using the term enhancements, but there's a penalty for first gradations is what I meant.
So the actual offense. I used the wrong word.
No, it was the gradations.
Can I ask a question? I guess I never really thought about this. How do people understand this? So I'm looking at 48.90401, I don't know where I am, something 2A. Any person who violates this subsection with respect to a controlled substance classified in Schedule 1 or 2 that is a narcotic or abusive drug. I read that, now that I'm really looking at it. I'm looking at the law. I don't know. That the narcotic or abusive applies to both Schedule 1 and Schedule 2.
Yeah. So it can include some Schedule 2 drugs as well.
And that B is controlled substance 1, 2, or 3, but not narcotic or abusive. Mm-hmm. So it's not Schedule 1 standing alone, just if it's a narcotic or abusive that is either on Schedule 1 or Schedule 2, it's up here. Is that?
Yes.
Everybody reads, that's like the law? Okay, I thought all of a sudden, does that narcotic or abusive only apply to Schedule 2 and Schedule 1 standing alone? Okay, so these are the narcotic and abusives?
Yeah, the ones that we have listed are, we just took from the current definition of abusive and narcotic drugs.
And so you're saying...
So what I'm saying is, but those are predominantly, if not all, Schedule 2 drugs. And then they have to be Schedule 1 drugs because of the definition of Schedule 1.
Right, so where are the narcotic and abusive in Schedule 1? What are we... Is
no,
that
I'm talking about in the actual definition of what goes in Schedule 1, 2, 3, whatever.
Yeah, I got it.
There are those definitions.
Right, but if we were... Somehow, I think this is sort of mapped. You're saying change the mapping because we're reforming.
Yes.
So this is a reform.
Yes.
Not a... This is change the mapping, put some Schedule 1, even though they're not narcotic and abusive, up in these higher gradations.
Because of the definition of Schedule 1. It doesn't make sense.
So this doesn't make sense currently.
Yes, because if a Schedule 1 drug is more dangerous than a Schedule 2 drug, and that's the criteria for either the council putting it on or the mayor being able to designate it, then it seems odd that you go through the process of declaring it a Schedule 1 rather than a Schedule 2 or 3, and then treat the Schedule 1 just like a less dangerous drug.
So you are recommending a total change in how these are penalized relative to each other would you suggest weight with them, that they figure out weight of whatever that Schedule 1 is, or... Is it?
We didn't go that far in the recommendation.
Yeah, well, I, right.
Which is a recommendation, from what I understand, was limited to the possession offense.
That's
not graded on weight.
That's right. That's exactly
okay.
right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I think, you know, one of the, the appreciate the kind of...
I see. Thank you.
More theoretical view of, like, you know, how this should be set up, and we're certainly open to, you know, rethinking how things are mapped. I think, you know, there is then the practical issue, what comes with that, what changes are being made. And it sounds like you didn't have any particular, you know, the psilocybin.
No, that's...
But that is the implicit effect of anything that we do recommend. And so I guess one thing I would say is, like, if there's any follow-up from anybody, but particularly OIG, since you're recommending this, mm-hmm. is, you know, look, conceptually, maybe that should, if we go this route that you're suggesting, kind of lumping together, getting not using this abusive narcotic drug distinction, do you then think there should also be changes to the schedules, right? For instance, with respect to psilocybin, because otherwise, I realize it's not what you're affirmatively saying, but what you are implicitly saying is that these will be treated the same. And if that's not what your office right wants, then we need, like, that level of detail then too, right? So I guess
hear you, and we can certainly, we'll review it and make recommendations.
Yeah.
One of the things we didn't want to start doing is coming up with definitional changes to the current schedules, because that has implications outside of what we're dealing sure. with here. And to me, that might be three other reports and a lot more comments. So we tried to do it the easier way. But we can certainly take a look at it.
When you say definition of the schedule, you mean
what
does Schedule 1 mean?
Yeah, okay. Because implicit in what he was saying is, why is psilocybin a Schedule 1 drug?
Right, because
there's another way of flipping
that
comment.
If the dangerousness, you're saying that should be taken seriously.
Yeah,
and that should
for Schedule 1 and 2, so that determines it. Then the question is, okay, we rearrange things to that. Do there then need to be changes in there, because how that historically has evolved? There are some places where things need to be rearranged, because in fact it hasn't been scrutinized, because it hasn't been there is no, you know, penalty difference associated with it in this place for it to even be come on people's radar. So that's, got other points.
That's it. So the comment, or just comment here, was from what I said, was limited to So with respect to the trafficking offense, which again still uses the same list of abusive narcotic drugs, that's okay, or is just sort of gets a little bit too messy to
where
use
we
the whole scheduling.
That's right.
Yeah, because that one is for whole schedule.
That's right.
Sort of abused. Okay. That's great. So bring it back. This comment again about the defense for when you distribute, not for financial gain.
Mm-hmm.
So OJ had this comment of, well, it seems like OJ is fine with that when it's, you know, sharing a single line at a party, but then should only be limited to something that I think the term is like single use.
But the single use, personal use. Yeah, I mean, we use single use because personal use is sort of a, you know, 3 grams might be personal use,
sure.
1 for now, 2 for tomorrow, you know, is personal use. But the question is, if you're sharing with somebody a party, it's one thing to say, you know, I'm going to give you one dosage.
Mm.
There right.
could be 2 doses. I mean, people could have a good time at a party, right? I mean,
yes, but the line's got to be drawn somewhere.
Sure, right.
And, you know, and so we were drawing the line at sharing at a party with your date, whatever, is different than a blanket exception where there's no remuneration at all, like we already talked, where there's no observable remuneration.
Because we were just what single use would mean, and you know, again, 2 lines is more than enough for, you know, 3 lines. Or your word, sort of
at some point, I guess we'd have to have an expert to explain what, you know, what a single dosage use is. And I'm not saying we're wedded to the language single dosage, but the concept is, it's one thing to have a small amount that you're sharing without remuneration versus having the obligation to prove that the sharing was without some sort of remuneration or trade of value. Because I think we had comments on some of the other stuff about, we talked about cash or whatever, and it was we really, our view is it should be for anything of value.
Can I ask, sorry to interject, but, you know, right, so again, single use is the kind of language put out here. Is there something, you know, in case law that, you know, has perhaps on a totally collateral, separate line of inquiry?
This is the punch bowl.
Uh-oh.
This is the punch bowl. I don't know what single use means, but you don't put out a line at a party. Now, I have no idea. I've only seen movies. I swear to God, I am such a goody-two-shoes. But in the movies, you don't put out a line. You put out a pile.
Well,
and Dave is greedy. Let's all be clear, right? So, like, I think there's enough for each of us to have a line, but some people help themselves. But, like, what did I do? I did, right? Don't you think this is the punch bowl where you took too much punch? Why am I on the hook for that?
No, I. You see, that's where we would disagree. I don't think that's the punch bowl. Because I think it's, which is why I use the, say, like, with your date. There's one thing, I had clients who were, you know, went to court, got positive drug tests, and they were like, you know, the judge said they were going to test you. I was like, well, I was with my girlfriend Saturday night. There's a difference between giving someone a single dosage when you're together and you're partying is different than bringing...
Oh, than a party.
Than bringing a half an ounce of cocaine to the party so everybody can get... That's right.
See, I'm with
if I get a single dose at a party, single dose to person A, single dose to person B, you would say the defense should not be available then. That's what I understand.
There's a gray area between
that's
one
really
and two.
View of what a date
when
is.
It gets to 10, yeah, then it doesn't apply. There is a gray area, and I'm not saying that we would necessarily stick to one, but any reasoned approach that gets the concept of, you know, some minor sharing for personal use is different than the situation.
Great. Let me just kind of say too points. For everybody, like any again. Follow-up, you have a thought, or where I was going before was, if, you know, maybe there is somewhere in the case law conceptual, you know, what we're trying to do is articulate better and more precisely something around this notion of a single use, but what exactly does that mean? Does it, is it...
Not single use, personal use.
Well,
and
that's right. I mean, like, that is, there are different degrees here, and the question is, there's a policy choice where you draw which conceptual distinction you're drawing, but there's also, it's a drafting matter, right? Just like difficulty in articulating specifically what is meant by personal use or you know, single use or any of these things. So if there's like more specific language on any of these, I mean, we, you know, look, the code can't obviously articulate all of these distinctions, and we could in commentary spell out some examples that would maybe helpfully draw out, you know, so we don't have to be perfect on this, but the better we could do at articulating any of these lines as to does personal use then mean not at all for sure, you know, like, you know, what exactly we mean by these lines, the more we can articulate that, even if it's in commentary, the better. So any further input on that would just particularly welcome.
If we just have personal use or single use, whatever it might be, I think, you know, every drug dealer distributes things for personal use, right? That's how everybody consumes them. So I think that I understand kind of keeping in the value part of it, but I think if that is what a drug trafficker does, right? I mean, a bottom tier person distributes things for personal use. And so I think that just having kind of exception for personal use might be overly broad.
But that's for
sure.
Financial gain.
We're
right?
Gonna,
so
we're
the defense is only
sure.
for non-financial gain. So,
right.
The defense would not apply to someone who's actually selling.
One other thing I want to say is in terms of the difference between financial gain and non-financial gain, and just this limitation. I think if you're, you know, giving things out to your friends at a party versus selling drugs at a party, I'm not sure what the difference in the harm necessarily is. You know, people are still, you're still giving away drugs and people are receiving drugs. It's kind of the same thing. The only difference is you're not getting money for it. You're kind of doing it out of benevolence. So I just think that it's kind of tricky distinguishing this of this something of value expectation, because I think when you get to that point, it is a similar transaction. It's about the transaction.
So PDS does make this point with respect to one of our recommendations, but I think this is should be, from our perspective, thought about with respect to this whole section, and that is, I think, the criminalization and the prosecution of drug offenses is like the prime place for racial disparity, and that I think it is fair and important to think about writing the offenses to limit the opportunity for racist enforcement of the law, and at a minimum, I think we could start with all picturing a group of white people doing the offense, and are we really going to prosecute it? Do we really think it's so terrible? Seriously, as an actual exercise in thinking about this, I do think drugs is just a huge, huge place where the enforcement of it has been incredibly racist. And I think when we were talking about marijuana decriminalization after however many years I'd been doing policy, it was the first, and I think it probably remains the only, in my experience, council hearing where the subject was really talked about in the context of racial justice. And I think that is true of controlled substances generally. I think that is true of how people think about it now. And I think there is a willingness to sort of view this way on the council, and that is something that the commission should think about when it's crafting this. I understand the U.S. Attorney's Office maybe personally believes it from the representatives here, may or may not, but certainly I'm not surprised at that office, in answer to my question of whether it really does have to be criminal, that I say, you know, here, have a line. Making zero judgment on that, that's fine if that's theirs, but when you are considering people's comments, I think it is absolutely fair to draw lines and make decisions that don't leave things up to prosecutorial or police discretion about who they arrest or who they prosecute, because this has been so unbelievably racist for decades.
Other comments? Sure. Yeah. Or does anybody want to follow up at this point?
Go ahead. About the next. When it comes to the paraphernalia offenses, so OG.
Oh, sorry. Let me interject one thing, which is also, again, court data. For now, it's kind of confidential, distributed to you, but it will include demographic data. So, unlike in the past, we didn't have that. This time we do. And so you'll be able to see kind of by conviction numbers and charging rates how the albeit flawed data collected by MPD on race, there's real data problems throughout all of this. And we can go into that later about how the court, the number of just data entry errors and how that skews data and et cetera. Race is a particularly difficult one also, but for what it's worth, we do have the data that's collected and kind of goes through the system as to race of defendants at the charging level and conviction level. And yes, you may want to consider that definitely as you think about penalties, but it applies broadly, right? I mean, it's maybe some offenses more than others raise issues of racial equity and enforcement, but penalties another place. So just for what it's worth, we're trying to give you that information and with that.
Just the paraphernalia. So again, for trafficking, we're still including all forms of drug paraphernalia, whereas for possession, we're only including the manufacturing type of paraphernalia. So OG noted was a seeming discrepancy. one way of addressing this discrepancy would be for, even for tracking paraphernalia, to only include manufacturing paraphernalia. And then the two offenses would be consistent. Does something like OG would be would consider, or...
Can you put it up?
Sure.
For my own limitation, I only brought the report 39 and 40. I didn't bring my
30s.
Yeah. So I don't have that one in front of me.
So what did you want it?
Page 30? What are we looking at?
This is the...
Possession or trafficking?
It's sort of both. It's the difference between the two offenses.
Possession.
I meant the OAG's comments. I didn't bring with...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I can pull it up on the screen.
No, I got it. Okay.
Page 4.
I thought we were talking guns in the hand.
You know, time permitting.
Just,
if everybody would just agree.
Yeah, page 4 to 5 of OG's comments. For possession, we require that it be manufacturing paraphernalia. For trafficking paraphernalia, includes paraphernalia for both distribution and ingesting the substances. And so OG noted a seeming discrepancy between the two offenses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one way of addressing that and making them uniform is to say for trafficking of paraphernalia, it would only cover trafficking of manufacturing paraphernalia. Right, and then the two offenses would be sort of parallel. They could be sort of graded, penalized differently, but substantively they would be very similar. I mean, would OG be okay with that change, that they would be kind of consistent with one another?
I guess the question is, what is the harm for those things that we would be excluding? Right? What are examples of the paraphernalia that is currently in trafficking but is not in possession?
So like selling...
Things like hypodermic needles,
or
right?
Needle, yeah.
Yeah, that's a place where I would need to double check with my office, but my personal view is it depends on the type of paraphernalia that you're talking about. That there's something different between selling and possessing a syringe. Say a syringe. Now, rolling paper is no longer legal, but that would have been the example that I would have used at the low end. So I think it's really the question of what the paraphernalia is. And if it's that dangerous that we don't want people to sell it, then why are we allowing them to possess it? Mm-hmm. When it's clear that that's the reason they possess it.
So, and just to kind of put a fine point on this, is the office taking the position against this provision? Are you just raising a question and you're not taking a position either for or against it?
Okay.
It's hard to kind of, you know,
I understand that. I get it. In the first instance, the more important one was that we wanted the commentary to explain why. Because it was not clear, and we don't know that if that's actually what the commission is going to be recommending, how you sell that to the city council, because it was not clear what the difference is. To the extent that you're asking for a second level recommendation, that's why I went into the thing about syringes. In that case, it would be a recommendation, I think, would be to make it as equally illegal to possess it if somebody can't sell it to you.
So you would recommend changing the possession of paraphernalia offense to include maybe not all tools to ingest
right.
drugs, but maybe
exactly.
like syringes.
Yeah.
Our thinking here is just that, you know, generally trafficking is sort of penalized more severely than possession, whether it's paraphernalia or the substance themselves. But if trafficking of paraphernalia is going to be a fairly low level offense anyway, then there wasn't a whole lot of room necessarily to go down. And so we were left with, you know.
I got you.
So
but,
can I ask the use? We can play back the tape. I feel like you said something. I know what you said. You said if it's dangerous enough that you shouldn't be selling it, then it's dangerous enough you shouldn't possess it.
Which is a flip of the way you usually think. That's right. That's what I said.
So, but I want to know what's dangerous about paraphernalia.
Well, this, say, a syringe that's only going to be used for heroin.
Right, but why? So, but...
So, by the...
Because it's a needle?
No.
Because
no.
People... So that,
it's heroin. It's... okay. I may not be explaining it well, because when I said that, I was using their current draft, which would penalize the distribution of the syringe, but not the possession. So the point I was really trying to make is, it's the demand that drives the sell. And so if there's a demand for syringes, it seemed odd to us that the selling of the syringe to somebody would be a penalty, whereas the mere possession of it would not.
Right, I hear you. I just sort of like, sometimes, actually it feels like every time we come to these meetings, you guys say things and then I think more. It is a danger.
Yay.
Or not. So I read this and I was like, oh yeah, this seems okay, but it's like what we do now. And then you talk and I think, wait, why are we doing this at all? Right? Like, why? As a legitimate question, I'm not trying to put you on the spot so I can, like, I don't know, do some jujitsu where you're, you know, whatever, I win. As a legitimate question, why do we criminalize paraphernalia? Like, get me on the drugs. If I've got drugs and we think that's bad and we should criminalize it, which... PDS does not take that position. But, like, if we were going to, okay, but so what? I have something to help me ingest. Like, why is that a problem? If I don't have the drugs, then what do you care that I have a syringe?
It's you don't have the drugs at the moment, right? The only reason you would have that syringe is so that when you get the heroin, you can use it.
Right, well, that's what's hard, though, because there are legitimate uses for syringes.
If it's a legitimate use for syringes, then it's not drug paraphernalia.
Or there's more...
By definition. So I was excluding those.
So I think there are also a number of areas in the law where the, like, proof issues are driving the... like, what conduct is being criminalized. I know that when I was in practice, I had at least one case where... they charged the person with paraphernalia because they saw the person using, and because they consumed the substance, they couldn't get them on the substance, so they charged this person with possession of a syringe. And that's the only... I don't know if that's the best way of going about policy, is figuring out, okay, well, if I can't prove that somebody actually did an offense, should I have some lesser thing that I can prove? But I think that that is probably the most common application of... the, like, at least syringe aspect of the possession.
It's like
for
a
personal
attempt.
Use only. The 30-day offense that we have in current law, I think that's probably the most...
So the... I'm sure you're right, and that that's...
I'm not saying whether that's good or bad. I'm
well,
just saying
except,
that like,
except that I think it's sort of... it's potentially valid, right? If we are going to criminalize possession and criminalize use and criminalize whatever, addiction... of these substances versus, you know, alcohol or something, then I guess I can see room for it. It does make me feel more like then it should be really, really narrow, because it's not actually that the syringe is so dangerous. It's that it really is a substitute prosecution. But there's a lot of, you know... I mean, it's one of the points that PDS made, although we made it about slightly different stuff, right? About, you know, I've got a bowl and some previous person used it for drugs, but now I own it and I was going to use it for cereal. You know, there are syringes in the house because I'm a diabetic, but someone I live with uses drugs. Like, what is that, right? Or I bought some syringes, they were on sale. Like, my dad was king of that, right? And you're like, we don't even drink fucking Dr. Pepper. But he's like, it was on sale. So syringes were on sale, and I don't have a plan with it. Like, just, I mean, there's sort of lots of legitimate stuff. Oh, I have some syringes. Here's some heroin. This works for me, right? It does seem... I could accept the policy point of it's a substitute prosecution. I think that's probably what it is, but then I think it means it should be on us to be really narrow about it, about what gets counted as paraphernalia, and if you're going to do a substitute, it should be super,
yeah,
super, super narrow, not the thing. Otherwise, get me on the drugs.
Yeah, it's not narrowly limited to if an officer observes you using it to ingest some substance, then it counts. It's just like having the thing itself is criminalized. It's not as narrow as that.
Future plans to use this thing to ingest. Sorry, current law, not what
current law is, right?
Right. Yeah.
Or if you've already, you know, used it years ago. I know that that's happened at the jail. People had paraphernalia left in their bag from college that they walked into the jail with. That they
didn't
even realize was there.
It could be you use it yourself, right? It could be
okay.
You know, you have a pipe that had been used to smoke crack or something, and you have it. Anyhow, yeah.
Good.
I don't
know there's much on that more point. To say on that point.
No, just one last
good.
Thing
go for it.
For OG. So OG, the comment. So we recommend repealing 48904.03A. This is sort of maintaining a house or building for the purposes of manufacturing and distributing. And so first, it sounds like OG is on board with repealing that.
In general,
okay. And then sort of to take its place, at least partially, OG recommended sort of an offense limited to methamphetamine production.
That's right.
I just want to make sure I'm clear on how this offense would work. So it was knowingly using a building, vehicle, or watercraft with intent to manufacture methamphetamine.
That was just one way of phrasing it. But the idea is that there have been, as we put, just random sites in there. But you go to the internet, and I went to numerous trainings over the years about how to identify meth labs and how they explode all over the place and the damage that they create to people who are either operating the meth labs, the neighbors of the meth labs, or the firefighters who are in there trying to put out the fires. And that is a more dangerous situation than simply maintaining a building where you've got a bunch of triple B balances and Ziplocs and you're measuring out drugs. And because of that, it was our office's position that particular operation be criminalized and have much more substantial benefits.
So that was just one way that we phrased it.
We're not wedded to that. If
the
commission has a better way of making it a model penal code kind of.
Right, because the way it was at least initially proposed by OG was that it was a semi-inchoate offense, so it's knowingly use a building with intent to manufacture, right? So it's if I'm living in my house, so first of all, it wasn't clear to us what use meant, and then, so if I'm just living in my house thinking, you know what, I'm going to start cooking meth here next year.
Yeah, that's not what we meant. What we meant was having an actual lab set up, whether or not the lab was being operated at the time the police was doing it. But if you have the chemicals necessary for the meth lab.
That's when the danger comes in
that we're concerned about is it exploding and the gases that affect,
like I said,
the neighbors and the firefighters and police, let alone the person who may be operating the lab.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah.
Good.
That's it for...
Good. Do you have anything last on drugs for PS or...
Just one or two quick things. So PDS had a comment about 48904.01E. This is a provision that allows people to be given probation for who don't have a prior conviction and have not previously received probation under that subsection. Mm-hmm. And so OG's comments was that addiction being something needs to be treated over time, but they want to remove the requirement, unless you allow people to go through have that probation under that subsection more than once. Mm-hmm. Did PDS also have any stance on whether the fact that the person had been previously convicted for possession, should that also, does he want that condition to remain, or... Because if someone's had been previously convicted of possession, regardless of whether they've been given probation under that subsection, they're ineligible.
I want to make sure I understand. So the way our proposal was written was you can get that provision more than once, and then the question is, let's say you got a conviction, didn't get it the first time, can you get it?
Right.
Okay, I think that that piece didn't occur to us, but yes, that a person should be able to get it.
Despite the prior.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, we're just trying to figure out specifically this would change, and
right.
that helps.
Okay. Yeah, and then last really quick thing, CPDS also recommended replacing the words. We have a location enhancement for distributing drugs near a public youth center. As far as this also crosses over with some of the weapons mm-hmm. offenses. And PS recommended changing public youth center to recreation center. Mm-hmm. And we're just sort of curious if that was intended to be a substantive change or if it was just supposed to be a clearer term for the same thing.
I think a clearer term for the same thing. There aren't youth centers, really. There are rec centers. There are rec centers in every neighborhood. That's
video game arcades.
Right, exactly. It's sort of like that.
I could not find one video arcade.
Oh, you couldn't find one, right.
Exactly. Really?
That's why
you
can
look
at adult
ones.
I couldn't find adult ones, yes.
Oh, okay.
Bars, but nothing
like
for kids. Couldn't find one existing right now.
No one does that anymore.
Right. Yes, I sort of feel like we should say that language
as a throwback.
A little
retro.
Funny, right, exactly. And yeah. they may make a comeback.
Library might be a historical reference.
No. That was all the sort of questions I had.
Great. Yeah. Okay, so anything else on drug offenses? I know this is largely because I took so long at the beginning doing intro, but... Well, potentially, or we could move on. We've got a few minutes left, and could get through a few things on weapons. But anything more on the drug comments that you want to talk together as a group?
It's very small in terms of the public drug center, perhaps also and community center, but it's kind of a different type of
right.
establishment.
Are you tossing that out as like, oh, that would be a better alternative?
If the commission goes with, he has recommendations about converting public youth center to public recreation center, perhaps public recreation center or public community center.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, the problem in all this is, like, yeah, these labels are nonspecific, so we'll look at it, you know, and if anybody happens to know, yeah, any other more precise definition elsewhere or that's used elsewhere in some other context that we could, you know, cross-site to and rely on for, like, designating these things. Otherwise, we'll do the best we can.
We could look at the... I mean, like, the phrase rec center and all of that appears, I think, in other parts of the D.C. law, right? Like, the permitting process and all that kind of stuff. We could look at that, those regulations. I don't know if I can't think of anything that's called a community center, but I certainly know what a rec center is.
Right.
And they have special
permits. I mean, there are defined rec centers and community centers in D.C.
is in there. Okay.
And
I don't know what the law says, but
exactly.
in terms of what actually exists,
the,
there are.
The labels,
like,
you
in
know.
The title.
Yeah, I mean, just in my neighborhood, there are rec centers, there are community centers, and those are kind of the options.
Good. Anything else on drug offenses at this moment? Otherwise, we can at least take that off the agenda for next meeting. Let's get started. We have a few minutes on weapon offenses, and I know Patrice had a few points to raise that we wanted to raise.
Do you mind opening
sure.
Memo 24?
Yeah.
So at the outset, I wanted to note that there are at least two typographical errors that were brought to my attention that I wanted everyone to be made aware of so that it isn't a surprise when it gets changed and so that people have an opportunity to comment if they misread my mistype or correctly read my mistype. So on page 5 of the memo, there's a red inked version of 7-2507.06, which is the current penalties provision. And you'll see there that what we intended to do is to strip out the parts of Title VII pertaining to possession of firearms and possessions of ammunition, and to retain everything in Title VII about sales and transfers and all of that we left alone. And unfortunately, I was not very precise in my unregistered firearm ammunition write-up, and it looks like I was replacing this entire penalties provision, and so I wanted to make clear that the A1 of
still.
This statute remains intact. So if that affects anybody's comments,
I don't. So the red line is what you intend.
The red line is
this,
and correct.
What's on the page is correct.
Yes.
And where does it match up in the report?
If you look at the report, the unregistered firearm offense, which is the first one in that report.
The Title VII. So the
yes.
Okay, uh-huh.
At the beginning of the commentary, there's an italicized part where we explain what it is that we're replacing mm-hmm. in each statute.
Right.
And I stated there that we're replacing 725.07.06, but we are not actually replacing the entire 725.07.06.
It's only in part. That was the distinction.
Okay.
It's just like...
Oh,
so
okay.
It came up
okay.
in some of the comments,
okay.
so we just mm-hmm. wanted to clarify that.
So that will be... That'll be fixed in the next draft there and in the table of contents where we list what we're replacing as well. And the second typographical error that I wanted to note, a lot of people picked up on, got a lot of notes on this, in 4503, which is possession of a firearm by an unauthorized person, so that's in the actual report, not the memo, sorry. We talked about this last time, but the...
What page do you want to go to?
No, I'm sorry.
No worries. You want the statute?
Yes, please.
Oops.
I know that's one that gets mentioned a lot of places. But it's
where?
I'm sorry, 4105.
Sorry.
What should I be looking at in the... He's looking for current law. Right?
No, I missed that.
No, in the RCC is what she's...
Oh,
here we go.
RCC is 4105. Okay, so if we scroll down to the court order provision, which is B2C, there should be an and after the semicolon at the end of little one, and that's consistent with current law that the person has to be subject to a court order that requires them to relinquish their firearms or ammunition and restrains them
so let me answer that one.
Yes.
That came up in context at the end of the last meeting about ERPOs. Extreme risk protection orders.
Okay.
So an extreme risk protection order, that's, I remember Kevin and I were talking about that, would satisfy I, but it doesn't satisfy Roman numeral II.
That's correct.
So therefore, how do we account for ERPOs?
This offense does not account for ERPOs, neither does the current 4503. ERPOs are not part of that. They're explicitly excepted from that, and you're supposed to rely instead on this lesser penalty that's inside the ERPO legislation. So a person is not supposed to be prosecuted for unauthorized possession based on having a firearm after an ERPO was listed. If they have a firearm after an ERPO was issued, they're supposed to be prosecuted under the ERPO statute,
and that provision would remain in place.
We haven't made any recommendations about that. We haven't changed it, though.
But I guess that brings up the question about... I understand that's what the council recently did,
mm-hmm.
and if Kevin's around, he could chime in.
I'd like to hear
Kevin's view on this, about what the logical difference is between an ERPO and a CPO for a domestic when it's a person who has a gun, and why there would be a penalty difference between the two situations if they're equally dangerous by definition, and they are prohibited from having them have one. So
I don't.
That would be the question I have, and I, like I said, if we can get Kevin's chime in, I think that would be helpful to the analysis, because I don't personally understand why they would have different penalties, and we are not dealing with penalties. We don't need to know if they have different penalties.
Right, it might be the same.
It might be the same, but I don't know why, and that's one of the reasons why the and was a question for us.
So yes, it was intended to be an and, so I apologize if that is something that you would have wanted to include in your comments and didn't because of the way that it was written. Do you have any other questions about that?
I didn't note this when I was reviewing it, but I understand that this is consistent with current law, with the kind of notice the court order only assaulting, harassing, stalking, or threatening. There might be a reason for this that I'm unaware of, why the current law doesn't also if there's a court order in place keeping you a stay away order, stay away no contact order. I understand that you're tracking current law, but it actually seems like it exempts an important category of persons who would be protected by the CPO.
I was
so just note that.
Yeah.
I understand it's consistent with current law, but that kind of gap in current law.
I was not able to glean anything from the legislative history about why it's written that way. It seemed to me when they were doing the ERPA legislation, and there's a reference to this section, that they were treating it as if it's that as if this language represents a CPO,
right?
A civil protection order.
Aside.
I think it's actually broader than that, right? Like it would include, you know, a no hats order that was issued in a criminal case or something like that. But that's, you know, that's what we have right now, and I can't find anything about why it doesn't have stayaways and no contacts. I'm not sure. On OAG's written comments, it says that OAG notes that giving a jury trial right when it is not constitutionally required does not improve the consistency and proportionality of the revised code. Rather, depending on the penalty which is established, this paragraph would give a jury right when a person is charged with the attempt version of this offense and would not give a jury right to a person who is charged with a different offense that has the same incarceration exposure. And because the like jury demandability issue has come up in a few other contexts and is something that you guys are going to, that everyone's going to be commenting on when you receive the report 41 tomorrow, I'm trying to understand exactly what OAG's position is. I'm not clear on whether this is a comment specific just to the unregistered firearm offense, or if it's
no,
OAG's position that across the board it doesn't improve consistency and proportionality to make...
I would phrase it this way. Mm-hmm. There have been a couple of... it's not specific to this offense, although that was a good example of it. There were a couple places in reports where, in the recommendations, where it says, and for these reasons, it is jury demandable. Whether it's got a constitutional implication, it's got something else going on, and I'm not sure that's something that OAG necessarily agrees with. And to us, proportionality is, you know, disproportionality is if I'm facing 180 days, she's facing 180 days, that without some sort of case law or constitutional requirement that one get a jury trial and one not get a jury trial, that it's disproportionate for me to get a jury for the 180 and her not to, just looking at what the penalty, the absolute penalty is for. So it is presaging, maybe, what our review will be of what's coming out afterwards. So, you know,
so, I guess there are different ways of sort of viewing what consistency and proportionality mean,
yes,
depending on whether you're talking
point.
About the penalty or talking about drawing the line on some other basis, right? So there is Supreme Court precedent for the notion that the penalty, the maximum penalty, is some indication of whether something is serious enough to be to require your Sixth Amendment right to mm-hmm. a jury. And I guess I'm trying to understand whether it's OAG's position that anything that's punishable by less than 6 months has to be.
I'm not saying has to be because we don't even know yet what the penalties for any of these are, which mm-hmm. is why in a couple of reports I think we have footnotes that say, and until we actually see the penalty, we reserve comment on any of this stuff. But I think the main point here is there is no case law of which we're aware. This is merely because the offense refers to a gun means you're automatically entitled to a jury trial no matter what the penalty is.
Okay. So OAG have any position on where that line should be drawn? Where, like, when offenses that are punishable by less than 6 months should be jury demandable and when they should not be?
Until we see a reasoned argument for why offenses of 180 days or less should be jury demandable, there's nothing for us to comment on.
But there's been arguments, right?
Well,
so
was,
the other
yeah.
places that I can think of offenses were
disorderlies.
Were disorderlies, right? Where they sort of said, you know, there's potential First Amendment implications to this, so it's probably pretty important to have a jury trial. I was sort of sitting thinking as we were transitioning from drugs to weapons that drugs is hard. Sex is another place. These offenses that are pretty sort of social and cultural. How we used to view sort of, right, you know, sodomy used to be criminalized. We were criminalizing homosexuality, and now we don't. And now we have also really different thoughts about sort of consent or whatever, right? Like our social thoughts about how, right, men can be raped too, right? Like our social thoughts about how sex crimes should be has really changed. And I think, you know, drugs obviously is also another place, right? That we're all, that like you guys just did paraphernalia. I don't know. Like that seems to me, that's a question that, you know, we all were just like, yeah, what should paraphernalia now be? As opposed to why are we doing paraphernalia? In thinking about these ones that are more cultural as opposed to like, don't kill anybody. Like, that's just not one that's really changed, right? So all that to say, where, you know, I think it is possible and valid beyond just the penalty. You know, we already have the, you're looking at 100 days, you're looking at 100 days, but one of you is going to get a jury trial because for one of you, there's immigration consequences, right? We already have that distinction going on in the law, although we also have a concurrence that's like, that seems kind of fucked up. Why don't we just give people jury trials? It wasn't quite worded that way. But I do think it is possible, and I think the commission has explained, you may not agree with it, but I think they have explained in some of these areas, the conduct might just not be that serious. Some of the disorderlies or I don't know where with respect to the Second Amendment or something, don't, you know, there's certainly a lot of people that would say all that stuff should be a felony, but where you might not, where it's a pretty regulatory thing, but we sort of say this is an area where the community should weigh in. That's what jury trials are. The community should weigh in. Peers should weigh in about whether this conduct meets that. So, I mean, you may disagree with it. I think that's legitimate.
Yeah, I think for disorderlies, we drop one of those footnotes that said until we see what the penalty is, we're not going to comment on the jury demandability. But I'm not sure that I agree with your premises. I'm sorry?
I'm just interested to learn, like, where everybody, I mean, I know everybody will have an opportunity to respond about jury demandability more generally, but I wanted to make clear that that particular line is not one that I invented or necessarily one that I would have even chosen. It's one that the citation to the legislative history in some of the public order offenses doesn't actually say, hey, because this has First Amendment implications, they should have a jury trial. It says because civil liberties are involved. And so that's why, by extension, in the firearm offenses, which also involves other rights codified very close to the First Amendment, that's why we also included the jury demand there. So if there is some principled way of, like, you know, saying where that line should be, as opposed to just offense by offense saying this should be jury demandable and this shouldn't, it would be really helpful to start being thoughtful about those things now, I think, because as we start to release the penalty recommendations, it's going to be more more helpful.
Yeah, and which is why, I mean, we all have our opinions about the 180 versus 6 months rule, but at least we know how the council felt on each one of those, on both the ones where they reduced the jury trial to 180 over the last 10 years, or where they refused to do that. And so, was it principle? I don't know. But it seems like the proposals so far are expanding jury rights in not necessarily in offenses that cover any sort of serious jail time, shall we say? And so the question is, why? I mean, I understand that there may be some stuff in legislative histories that talk about that, but were those in situations where they ended up calling it a 180-day offense? And all the disorderlies, there was discussion about penalties, and it came in keeping it at 180 days, no jury trial.
Would you agree that where the council has said, okay, we're giving a small penalty here, but we want it to be jury demandable, that it should be jury demandable?
Sure. If that, if we're consistent with ones where they drew the opposite conclusion.
Okay. Okay. And then the other OAG question that I had.
Good. We're right at noon. No, I will say. So unless it's a super quick one.
No, because then I'll answer it and it'll make me mind. And start thinking again.
Let's hold off. We'll carry this over, you know, any further discussion to the next meeting along with penalties. Again, it's noon, so we'll call it a wrap for the meeting. And yeah, again, go back on the penalties. Don't hesitate to give a call if you have questions. I think in the end it'll be fairly self-explanatory that, you know, as usual, you get something in a report, you comment on it, you can kind of say whatever you want. The one thing I want to be clear on again is that we put some model numbers up there. Those are just that, and we're not recommending any particular model numbers. And I say that in the report, but I'll just say it again out loud. you know, that may be useful or not, but yeah. Thank you all.
Can I just say, I'm going to get teary. I love our jury system. I think it's really